I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast on this fine Monday morning, the day after the ATP and WTA Tours have crowned champions in Stuttgart, Munich, Bucharest, Rouen and Barcelona. I don't think I'm missing anywhere there. Lots to talk about, lots to look ahead to. David's here. Hello, David.
Hello. Yes, it's a lot of tournaments, isn't it? It did take some following over the weekend, particularly obviously when they overlapped and clashed as per usual. But also I found it quite an invigorating week of tennis. I enjoyed lots of the storylines. I felt slightly shortchanged once or twice. I felt like there were a couple of stories brewing that we were going to get the full house. But overall, I feel like that's a bit pedantic to complain about, because overall it was pretty cool.
Yeah, we've gone from lots happening to nothing happening. There is now no live tennis available because we are in week one of a two-week combined 1,000 event, which means that pretty much until the weekend, nothing of interest or import will happen. So thank you, tennis scheduling, once again. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thankfully, Catherine, we have a new Taylor Swift album to listen to, which will see us through
at the clay court season and said, this is a convenient time for them. And we appreciate you, Taylor, for doing that. Yes, Matt and I, it's like we've got homework to do. Learning 31 new Taylor Swift songs. And we've somehow fitted it in around watching tennis. So not all heroes wear capes. We have lots to talk about. Before we get into it all, I'm going to tell you about On Location, who are sponsoring this edition of the Tennis Podcast. They are, of course, the premium hospitality and experience provider. On Location has cracking ticket, hospitality and travel packages available for pretty much all of the best and biggest tennis tournaments in the world. That includes Roland Garros, Wimbledon, the US Open, the Australian Open and the Laver Cup. And you might have heard one of the things we're going to be talking about in today's show is Rafael Nadal. Well, just this morning, the news has broken that Nadal has committed to be part of Bjorn Borg's Team Europe in Berlin at the Laver Cup from the 20th to the 22nd of September. And On Location is Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours are the official travel package provider for the Laver Cup. So if you want to go and you want to do it in style, then On Location are the people to go to. They can offer a five-night stay in the five-star Ritz-Carlton Berlin, official Laver Cup tickets, a Berlin tour and welcome dinner. And you can also add on plenty of hospitality options as well to your package. We have a 5% discount for all of those packages for friends of the Tennis Podcast. So if you want to access that, drop us a line at friends@tennispodcast.net, friends@tennispodcast.net to get the discount code if you are already a friend, or become a friend to qualify for that discount. And of course, you'll also get access to all the other brilliant stuff that we've put on the platform for friends of late, including The Barge, our Christine Truman Tennis Relived episode, and the documentary TV film review show that we're going to be recording and uploading tomorrow. So become a friend to get access to that 5% discount code for Laver Cup packages. Terms and conditions apply. So we will talk about Nadal, we will talk about Barcelona, but I think we're going to start in Stuttgart with the WTA Tour and Elena Rybakina becoming the champion, becoming a champion on clay. She beat Marta Kostyuk 6-2, 6-2 in the final, her third WTA 500 title of this season. She also, of course, won Brisbane and Abu Dhabi. We will talk about the final and we'll, of course, talk about Marta Kostyuk. But the real match that won her this title, I think, was beating the top seed and defending champion Iga Świątek in the semi-final in three sets. And the fascination, David, of the Świątek-Rybakina head-to-head continues.
Oh, it's just delicious. And it's perhaps even more so on this surface. I think them against each other on clay, indoors, and I know we only really get it once a year because Stuttgart's the only indoor clay court tournament on either tour, but it is just about perfection because I think certain conditions can probably favour Świątek more. I was asked you just in conversation the other day, both of you, do you think Świątek's better indoor on clay or outdoors? And as the week went on, and it's perhaps an easy thing to say after she's lost a match, but I just feel like her game with some conditions becomes even more difficult to contain. Whereas Rybakina, in steady conditions like that, is able to trust what's coming. Yes, there might be violent spin on the ball and angles and so forth, but she's able to get used to it, I think, in a way maybe it's perhaps more difficult outdoors. And I think it just shows ultimately what an incredible tennis player she is, what a ball striker, what a hand-eye coordination she has, and really good movement, particularly for somebody of her size. And she was always in the ascendancy in this match, and Świątek was always trying to reel her in. That's what I was getting from it. There were so many games where Świątek's just trying to hold on to a serve when she's been put under pressure. And that return, that ball strike, that consistency, I don't think even Rybakina was at her very best in this match, but it was still good enough. And I think it really sets up this clay court season nicely now, because I love domination. I love watching Iga Świątek dominate because she's so impressive. But I really prefer seeing that domination, that majesty being threatened like this. And it was in the previous match that Świątek had against Raducanu, which we can come on to in a bit. But Rybakina has consistently done this throughout their rivalry, throughout her career. She's caused her problems. And it makes me just want to watch them come up against each other more in these next two or three.
Matt, is this a straight up matchup issue for Świątek against Rybakina? It's not just Rybakina, is it? We talk a lot about her slight weak spot against those big, languid hitters and ball strikers. Or, and this is specific to Rybakina, or is it that Rybakina's top level is higher than Świątek's top level?
I've sort of been asking myself the same questions, really, and I'm not sure I have a definitive answer yet. This was maybe one of the times where I thought, you know what, maybe this isn't a matchup problem. Maybe this is just what happens when two really good players come up against each other. And I think we so often think of Iga Świątek as this incredibly dominant figure because she lays down these incredibly dominant scores so often. So to see her lose a match on clay makes you think, wow, is there sort of something a bit wrong with her? But I don't necessarily think there was. She's just playing a really good player in Elena Rybakina, who, yes, I think has some matchup advantages against Iga Świątek. Like, as David spoke about, she can really step in on those returns and put Iga Świątek's second serve in particular under a lot of pressure. We saw her do that. I also think Świątek hasn't quite figured out how to return Rybakina's serve. I don't know whether she knows whether to stand in or step back. It strikes me that she really needs to try and develop a bit of a block or chip return just to start some rallies, because actually once she gets in the rallies, Świątek, she's got so many skills on a clay court to get Rybakina moving, and like she can be okay in those rallies, but starting off is just so hard against Rybakina, who's got the big serve and the big return. But, you know, Świątek won their previous match in the final of Doha on a hard court. So they're 1-1 this year. They've had very similar seasons in terms of the titles that they've won. Świątek's won the bigger titles with a couple of 1,000 events to her name. But Rybakina is sort of consistently reaching finals now. Like, it's just a really good rivalry. So I still think Świątek remains the player to beat on clay. Like, I think her record at Roland Garros speaks for itself. She feels like the most likely one to get to the latter stages of that tournament. She's been such a guarantee there over the past 3 or 4 years. But actually, I was looking at Rybakina's Roland Garros record after this title, and it's sneaky good, you know. It is a sneaky good record she's got there. It was 2021 where she beat Serena. That was sort of her breakout win at a slam. She'd obviously done things just before the pandemic, but that was a really big win. It took Pavlyuchenkova beating her 9-7 in the third that year. Pavlyuchenkova, of course, went on to reach the final. And then 2022, it took Madison Keys 7-6 in the third to beat Rybakina at Roland Garros. So kind of overtime needed to beat Rybakina at Roland Garros in the past few years. And then, of course, last year, she looked good for two rounds and then had to withdraw. So, like, I definitely think the one player Iga Świątek is not going to want to face at Roland Garros is Elena Rybakina, because of that pretty good record she's got at Roland Garros, this ability to hurt Świątek in the matchup. But I do think that Iga Świątek, it's not to me like a Federer against Nadal right at the early stage of that rivalry, where it's like, oh my goodness, Federer just is being absolutely pinned in the backhand corner. He's got kind of no answers. It's a very clear matchup problem. Like, I think there are advantages for Rybakina in the matchup, but I do think that Świątek's got ways to really hurt Rybakina as well. And it sets up the rest of this clay court swing just perfectly.
Yeah, I think it's my favourite rivalry at the moment on the WTA Tour. I think if I had to pick one to consistently be happening within the realms of realism, I mean, obviously there are fantasy rivals that, you know, I'm not, to quote Taylor Swift, I'm not waiting for, but I am carrying a torch for. You know, in my heart, Andreescu and Osaka, that rivalry will still happen one day. but of the realistic rivalries at or near the top of the sport that are happening but just aren't happening with the regularity that we crave, I think Rybakina and Świątek would be the one for me. I love the contrast in the way they do things. Świątek's technique is so effortful, isn't it? For me, I find it less appealing, but it's never more appealing to me than when it's in stark contrast with Rybakina's languid, easy style. I find that contrast utterly compelling. And I do wonder how much it'll rattle Świątek to have lost to Rybakina on clay. And it's a good point you make, Matt, that, well, Świątek's got one over on Rybakina on hard courts this year, so it's kind of even Stevens. But I do, you know, mentally, I do wonder if this will just shake Świątek a bit, that Rybakina has landed a tank on her lawn.
It certainly makes the next couple now even heightened interest. And I think that, you know, they're always exciting and there's a lot to look forward to. But yeah, this puts a little bit of doubt into things in a way that, I mean, I've been looking at Świątek really as the Nadal of the WTA Tour for the last couple of years, really, during the clay court season. And yeah, I mean, she's still playing well, but that's two players in a row who've got close to her and one's beaten her. And now we get to move it along. And I do feel I like these little sagas. You know, we've got one in the Barcelona final to talk about later. And I just like these little ongoing returns, rematches, what they're going to come out with next. It's also, it's not only just sort of the emotional, I want to get revenge. It's the, what tweaks am I going to make? And how's that going to match up?
Just sort of specifically on this, on this semi-final, I was really thinking what you just said there, Catherine, about could this get in Świątek's head. When she lost that first set, I thought her energy was bad in that first set. I think she went a break up immediately and then lost a string of games, and it was pretty one-sided in Rybakina's favour. I thought, I know she went on to lose the match, but I thought that like the next two sets were reasonably encouraging from that point of view for Świątek. I thought her body language was a lot better once she went off the court and came back, and I didn't feel like she was really getting down on herself in those last two sets. Like it was nip and tuck. I agree with David. It always felt like Świątek was chasing a little bit. It felt like Rybakina was the one in control, but there were so many big points and the deuce games and break points, and Świątek was playing them well. And I think if it had really been in her head, she might not have played those big points quite so well. So I was pretty encouraged by the sort of approach and attitude that Świątek had, even in defeat. And again, as David said, Stuttgart being indoors is a little bit of an outlier clay court event. Like, I know Rybakina did get that win sort of technically over Świątek in Rome last year, but that ended by retirement, didn't it? But if Rybakina were to go to Rome and beat Świątek ahead of the French Open, I think that would be a real sort of blow against Świątek's confidence. As it is, I think Świątek still sort of backs herself really on this surface, even against, you know, her biggest rivals.
The good news for Świątek is she doesn't need to make room in her garage for an extra Porsche. Rybakina perhaps needs to build a garage because she's won herself a Porsche and doesn't have a driving license, which is very tennis player, isn't it? So if you're in Elena Rybakina's inner circle, you might be sort of trying to be in the right place at the right time for if she's having a generous moment. Like, do you remember on the Champions Tour, David, when, you know, players would win a Jeroboam of champagne or something, and the last thing they wanted was to be having to pay excess baggage for an enormous bottle of champagne on the flight on the way home. So if you just made sure you loitered in the right place at the right time, I became pretty expert in acquiring big bottles of champagne from aging tennis players.
I got one.
Never scored a Porsche, but
no, I got one of those, Catherine, on the court at Royal Albert Hall from John McEnroe. In fact, he announced it over his microphone to the crowd that he was going to give his bottle of champagne to me. I think it was about a prediction I got right, actually. but anyway, and then I got one from Cedric Pierlein when he won Nottingham. And that was very clearly, I can't get this in my baggage. And actually, we kind of get on, so here you go. And I was like, well, I can't carry that on the train.
I'll just have to drink it now.
I think we dispensed of it on the day.
Yeah. It's the only thing to do. Two huge name drops, David, the big Pierlein McEnroe duo. Somebody around Elena Rybakina is probably getting a free Porsche, or she's going to hastily try and pass her driving test. No Porsche for Marta Kostyuk. Incredible week for her, though. I'm going to say against the odds, reaching the final, beating Coco Gauff, Markéta Vondrášová on the way. But it feels like everything of note that Marta Kostyuk does is against the odds. Like, that's how she wins tennis matches, right? There's something, I mean, and there's, it's very easy to, you know, bring the whole being Ukrainian situation into this and sort of overlay that narrative on it. But everything about the way she plays tennis and wins tennis matches is like she's fighting against the tide and yet somehow, you know, coming out on top most of the time. And yet you also have this feeling of you're waiting for her to hit the wall and you're like, okay, it's not going to be in this match. Will it be in the next match, though? Because it has to happen eventually. And of course, that happened in the final against Elena Rybakina. But I am going to remember her quarterfinal against Coco Gauff, which Matt and I watched the majority of together on Friday. I am going to remember that match for good and bad reasons for quite some time.
Yeah, I can't decide whether I love Coco Gauff versus Marta Kostyuk matches or hate them, because that's two they've played this year, which have been very compelling, but I wouldn't describe as good. And that's fine.
I don't think they bring the best out of one another, do they, quality-wise?
No, which...
Why is that?
Which is strange. I mean,
it's weird, isn't it?
They are quite similar in terms of, they're two of the best athletes on the tour. I think they're such great movers, and it does seem like the rallies just go on and on. And like in Australia, it was a really hot day. It was tough to play good tennis in those conditions. I sort of give that one a bit of a pass maybe, but this one was just, it was so tight and nervy, and like you just did not know what was coming off Coco Gauff's racket. I mean, there's one swing volley which sticks in my head, which pretty much hit the back fence. And then when she was match points down, she suddenly found the middle of the strings and played this inspired tennis. And it eventually took Kostyuk, I think, 8 match points to get over the line. Like, they are wild sort of roller coaster matches, but not always the highest quality. But I did find both matches they've played this year pretty compelling. And yeah, that's a heck of a run to the final for Kostyuk. 3 hours against Siegmund, say 5 match points against Jungshin Wen, survived that epic against Gauff, beats the Wimbledon champion von Droschwa in the semis. And that's 3 tournaments in a row now. Final in San Diego, quarterfinals at Indian Wells, and final in Stuttgart. And, you know, to go with an Australian Open quarterfinal as well. Like, this is some real consistency for Marta Kostyuk, which is great to see. And yeah, like in tennis years, okay, she's 21 years old still, but she's been around for so long. She's kind of a mature 21 year old in terms of, you know, the amount of tennis and sort of experiences that she's had. And yeah, it just all seems to be coming together this season, which is really great to see.
It is. I mean, she's you can't take your eyes off her. It's not always pretty. Like, she's not the cleanest hitter of the ball, and I think maybe that's something that with Gauff and Kostyuk, like, they neither of them seem to be hitting that cleanly against one another. I don't know whether that's just sort of an alchemy of one another's ball coming back to the other. But yeah, you absolutely cannot take your eyes off it. Von Droschwa, of course, having beat Sabalenka in the quarterfinals, there was a moment when we thought it was going to be the top four in the semifinals. But of course, along comes Marketa Von Droschwa to make herself relevant for the first time this season, just when you least expect it. It's the most Marketa Von Droschwa thing ever. And we had Emma Raducanu continuing her run of relevance last week as well, didn't we? Ran into Iga Świątek in the end, challenged her, took her to a tiebreak in the opening set, and okay, wasn't able to take it to a third, but gave Iga Świątek a good run for her money. And of course, before that, beat Angelique Kerber and Linda Noskova. This is, she's putting something together now, Emma Raducanu, and it's really exciting, David.
Well, frankly, I although there are differences because of injury and so forth, I draw some parallels with Marta Kostyuk, because Kostyuk came along as a 15-year-old and had extraordinary results at the Australian Open and then kind of disappeared. And then you know, obviously she's having and has had the trauma of everything happening in Ukraine, but she sort of had to build herself as a tennis player. And we're now seeing the potential coming out week after week. It's taken 2.5 years, more even, for Emma Raducanu to go from winning the US Open out of the blue to really struggling physically to have a body that can withstand the rigors of the tennis tour. And, you know, lots of discussion about coaches and all the stuff. The brilliant column that Hannah wrote about Emma Raducanu last week, that's available for Friends of the Podcast now, was all about how we're being reintroduced to this player. We're learning about who she is, what sort of player is she. And when I'm going through it, I'm like, yeah, I she's perhaps the player I most enjoy watching, and yet I least know, because we just haven't had a chance to see her very much. And when you get chance to watch her in back-to-back matches, you realise just how good she is, just how capable she is of mixing it with the very best. Now, Angelique Kerber is some years past her best, you would think, but she's gone and taken her on in Stuttgart, in her home country, and she's really beaten her comprehensively, and she's done it with some guts and stubbornness as well. It wasn't just shot making, you know. She got broken in about a 12-minute game of 9 juices and several break points, and then barely lost another game after that. You know, she backed that up against Linda Noshkova, who's incredibly hit and miss, you know, but on a day is dangerous. And there's one set that's 6-love, the next one's really close, but Raducanu won both of them. And then she's followed that up with Świątek. And she's gone toe-to-toe for a tie-break set. And there are not many that do that on clay. And she was showing that she's got the goods. But it's about trying to build a resistance to the circuit, to the rigours, to the everyday grind. Because that is tough. That is not winning the US Open out of the blue. That's doing what Kostyuk's done: get to a quarter final, then have a week off, then get to another quarter final, then get to a final. I mean, I find it extraordinary how these players are able to do it. But if you want to be a regular feature of the tour, that's what you have to be able to do. And this is the first chance we've properly had a chance to see Raducanu do that since Wimbledon fourth round in 2021, followed by qualifying and all the rest of it over that summer, and then finally ending up winning the US Open. That's not to say this will be repeated right now, but equally, why shouldn't it be? She is good enough to be a problem for any player there, and I just want to see it all the time because I love watching her play tennis.
Well, she's played good tennis in Madrid before. A couple of years ago, I was out there in Madrid. She lost to Kalinina in the end, but she'd won a couple of matches before that. I'm intrigued to see what she can do in Madrid. Of course, she could do with getting her ranking up so she can get seeded at these events. She's going to have tough draws, but it's so much fun to have her being a proper player or developing into a proper player on the tour. Tennis is better for it.
Yeah, there was a stat I liked that sort of illustrated just what a tough match that was for Świątek. It was the fourth longest straight set win of her career, over 2 hours. Like, Świątek is much more likely to play a match under 1 hour than she is play a match over 2 hours. And yet that was a really, you know, the first set incredibly tight, second set Świątek always sort of in the lead, but Raducanu kept it close. And yeah, it's really encouraging. She's hitting her forehand so much better than I have seen, like really going after that shot, and at times has looked like she's lacking power in the past on that ball, but not at the moment. It's great to see, and yeah, let's just hope that she can keep coming through these tournaments sort of unscathed physically, because if she can, I've no doubt that the level is good enough to be competing with the best players.
She's got Matt excited about a forehand, which I can tell he takes some doing. He is He's not a forehand guy. Świątek, by the way, last thing on her. She this week marked her 100th week as the world number one, consecutive 100th week, which
there was a small Sabalenka period in the middle there.
There was. Mm. Oh my God, Sabalenka erasure from me. Terrible. Yes, sorry. 100th week as world number one. Don't editorialise on the agenda, Catherine. That's what we've just learnt there. If Matt hasn't put it in, it didn't happen. it moves her into 9th on the all-time list. That is in the agenda. I feel confident of it. Moving on to Rouen and the other WTA event happening last week. Won by Sloane Stephens. She beat Magdalena 6-1. 2-6, 6-2 in the final. En route, she also beat Peyton Stearns, Yuan Nui, Karolina Pliskova, who I think is who Raducanu has drawn in the first round of Madrid, actually.
Yes, although she's just withdrawn.
Oh, right. Great. Again, wasn't in the agenda, didn't need to say it. And Caroline Garcia as well, also a victim of Sloane Stephens last week. Don't know what to make of this really, other than to say I am so here for Sloane Stephens being a factor of whatever level on clay.
I love it.
Or anywhere, quite frankly, but definitely
on
clay.
I think it's a big deal, Catherine. I really do. I think she did this last year as well. She played a lower level tournament and won it. And I just feel like it's sad to say in a way, but Sloane Stephens hasn't been a factor at the top for a while. You know, she'll have little moments, but you know, she's not playing Stuttgart. She's not competing at the very latter stages of the big 1000 events, but she's certainly capable of doing it. And I feel like she's got to rebuild in order to do it. And I love that she's gone to Rouen and has experienced something else. You know, she often used to be regarded as almost a poor tourist. I remember when she won the US Open, she then went on that run of half a dozen tournaments, I think in Asia, and lost in the first round of all of them. And it was almost as though she just wasn't into it, you know, wasn't really that into being away and away from the States. And here she is playing tough players. I mean, I watched a good 20 minutes highlights reel of that final against Magda Linette. It was a good match, actually, but Linette really playing aggressive tennis that I wasn't quite expecting, but both of them just going for broke and Stephens just digging in and coming out on top. And I don't know whether that is transferable when you get up against the better players at the bigger tournaments, but I think that's her best bet because she's got to rebuild. So much of this going on, isn't there? But I love that she's gone down to a slightly smaller tournament. You know, you talked about Naomi Osaka doing it last week, Catherine, and being pleased that she was doing it. And I think this is similar. Obviously, Sloane Stephens is a much more natural clay court. But you're right. Watching her on clay is like watching an art form. You know, she just makes things so appealing to look at.
Yeah, it's pretty staggering to me that was her first WTA level title on red clay. She'd won Charleston before back in 2016 on the green clay, but you know, that's pretty mad, I think, for someone who has, you know, made the Roland Garros final and has reached the second week there 9 times. And honestly, you sort of ask what this result means. What I think it means for me is that I'm probably going to do something very irresponsible with Sloane Stephens in my Roland Garros predictions, because I always get sucked into Sloane Stephens because, like, she can look so good when she gets that blend right, you know, when she's defending and you just think, how's anyone going to get the ball past her? But then she's also got this attacking sting in her game that if she wants to finish points, she just really can. And yeah, she had to dig her heels in that final against Magda Linette, dropped the first set of the tournament that she played as well against Peyton Stearns, and you know, was up for the fight. And that's what you love to see. And I was actually looking at the sort of Roland Garros odds, and like, the following players are all favoured ahead of Sloane Stephens at Roland Garros, right? Simona Halep, Mira Andreeva. Oh,
she's just pulled out of another event, unfit.
Yeah. Naomi Osaka.
Andreeva's a child, Okay. Then Osaka lost round one in Rouen. Okay.
Alina Svitolina.
Okay.
Jessica Pegula.
Yeah.
Paola Badosa. Linda Noskova.
Is this correct post winning Rouen?
Yes, Matt. I checked this morning.
Linda Noskova.
Yeah, and Maria Sakkari. All of those are higher in the odds than Sloane Stephens for Roland Garros. And look, maybe Stephens is such a sort of known quantity now. Like, perhaps that works against her. Maybe some of those players that I've just mentioned are a bit more unknown. So then maybe you think maybe they're more likely to do something outrageous. Like, Stephens has consistently sort of got to about the fourth round at Roland Garros and then sort of fizzled out and lost. But I don't know,
It took a great Sabalenka performance last year to take her out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So I just looked up her. Warning you, I'm probably going to do something outrageous if she has another good week. I'm going to lose my head with Sloane Stephens.
Her ranking right at this moment is 33. I tell you what, every top player is hoping she has another run pre-Roland Garros and gets herself seeded. I mean, I know there'll be withdrawals and the current ranking will probably get her in, but I think everybody would like it to be confirmed that Sloane Stephens will be seeded at Roland Garros. Wow, I'm reading from that list. I am shook. Why don't we just quickly touch upon one of the players that's in that list as a favourite over Sloane Stephens to win Roland Garros, Naomi Osaka. As you say, David, went to Rouen, kind of dropped down, still a WTA level event, but by far the smallest that she has played since her comeback and the most accessible draw in terms of ranking. And she comes up against Martina Trevisan in the first round, who is just, you know, effortlessly comfortable on clay. And that's really exposed. The thing with this dropping, I still believe that was the right thing to do for Naomi Osaka, but she's going to have to keep doing it. I think she's going to have to keep showing up at these smaller events. Yeah, you know, she'll play Madrid and Rome and Roland Garros and all the rest of it, but she is going to have to play, I think, quite a lot of these smaller events to really get something going. And that's going to be tough because that can't have been a fun experience. Four-time Grand Slam champion rocking up to Rouen and losing in the first round to Martina Trevisan in what I thought was quite a lackluster performance from Osaka. I was a bit disappointed in her lack of grit. She was really competitive in the opening set, had a couple of break points, I think, on the Trevisan serve midway through it. And when she didn't take those, her head dropped and her whole, you know, she was like an unwatered plant then. She just started to droop. And I thought that was a bit disappointing. But I just hope she sticks with it.
Yeah, what I would say is I am quite reassured by the way she's communicating. She's communicating quite often, and she seems to be just accepting this as a process and a journey, and she seems to be kind of getting something out of it, even so. And I like that. But it has been a feature of her comeback to this point, is being pretty good, being often the better player for the first portion of a match and getting us excited, but not winning big points, not winning sets that level of play should probably win. So maybe that is just a question of repetition. On the clay itself, I mean, there are just some glorious strokes she hit down the line with the backhand sort of thing she does on a hard court, and then the familiar discomfort and lack of being a natural on it just came to the fore. And but no, I'm hopeful because of the way she's talking, and so keep at it is the hope. Yeah.
Do you just going back to those odds, which they're going to live rent free in my mind until
she's the most silly one. I think of that group, putting her, I think,
Noskova,
her inclusion
David.
Ahead.
David. Linda Noskova.
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean,
Badossa. At least she's...
She's not fit.
Done something
Badossa
recently.
Is absurd.
At least Badossa's, A, got clay court pedigree, and she pushed Sabalenka to 3-all in the third set before she got injured last week. She was playing well. I mean, obviously, I know she hasn't done much recently.
Something
but...
revolting if Paula Badossa wins the French Open. I'll do whatever you want. Name the dare. Listeners, name the dare, and I will do it if Paula Badossa wins the French Open.
I said I'll sing the Marseillaise if Artur Fils gets to the semi-finals.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, great.
So we could
like
do a duet.
Catherine's going to eat something
I
awful.
Do you not know
and Matt's going
to
sing
to the Spanish national anthem?
I think eating is far less humiliating than singing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you know I'll eat anything. Promised... I'd rather eat feces than sing publicly. Don't quote me. I mean, I'm exaggerating for comic effect, but you get the
Don't
idea.
Don't quote me, she says on a podcast.
I was going to try and make a sensible point about those odds. Oh, I was just going to ask, do odds compilers still exist, or is it just AI now? Would it just be an algorithm compiling those odds, or is there a human being somewhere going, I'm having a Sarkar Noskova over Sloane Stephens? Let us know if anybody knows. Okay.
We don't promote betting on this podcast, folks. Can you tell?
Yeah, but we can acknowledge that it exists.
Yeah, we can. Like, we can listen. It is a market out there which actually measures performance of players and likelihood of things happening, and it is actually quite interesting
I mean,
to see
it's
how
a,
it stacks
up. It's a science. I'm interested in that. Answers on a postcard, let us know. You can do a combined communication, let us know about, answer our odds compiler question and let me know what my dare should be if Paula Badossa wins the French Open.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We're going to talk about Barcelona, Munich and Bucharest in a moment and a few other bits and bobs as well. But I just want to take a moment to tell you about the Tennis Relived episode that we recorded for Friends of the Tennis Podcast this week. It focused on former French Open champion, Wimbledon finalist, the last person, the last of two people to compete in an all-British Wimbledon final. With Angela Mortimer, of course, it is Christine Truman. She was the focus of our most recent edition of Tennis Relived. David and I went to Wimbledon, where she's still a regular member. We spent an hour and more in her company, and it was an absolute joy. We've had such wonderful feedback from this podcast, and I'm so pleased that that is the case. We were on such a high after spending time with Christine. So if you're on the fence about becoming a friend of the pod, or you already are a friend of the pod but haven't had the time to listen to Christine yet, here is a little teaser for you of what you'll be in the store for.
That was my dream. I think one of my dreams was to dance the opening dance at the Wimbledon Ball. And I always thought that would be the perfect ending. So I always had my dress for my four semifinals, but never got to use it for the opening dance.
Have you ever worn the dress?
Oh, yes, quite an expensive dress, Catherine. So.
Good, I would hate to think of a beautiful, sad, never worn ball gown.
Yes, no, I went to the ball anyway, but some things just don't happen the way you would like.
But you did get even closer.
Yes, I did. I got to the final and I led 6-4 and 4-3 and 40-30. So 5 points from winning. And I slipped and fell. The court had been a bit of a moist day, a bit of drizzle around. And I slipped and fell. And I'd already been, my first injury, actually, was an Achilles tendon injury. It's a horrible injury for an athlete or a sports person. So when I fell, I thought, oh no, not my Achilles tendon, and so lost my concentration. And rightly so, Angela Mortimer, who I was playing against, took advantage, which you should do when you're playing a match and competitive. And so I lost five games in a row very quickly and went from 6-4, 4-3 and 40-30 to 3-love down in the final set. And I came back a bit, but not enough. I lost 7-5, so lots of tears shed over that. A big disappointment, of course, but that's life.
I read an interview from a number of years ago in The Telegraph with you and Angela together, Ian Chadband's interview, sort of reunion on centre court, and he was asking about that slip when you were 5 points away from victory, and he asked you both, was that the turning point? And Angela immediately said, no, I think I would have won anyway. And you said, well, I think it was the turning point, actually. How much do you think of that moment as sort of the sliding doors moment? Do you imagine the alternate reality where you didn't have that slip?
It goes on through life, my life, Catherine, actually, in that it still irritates me, and I feel slightly, not miffed. I mean, I'm glad that she won. She was 29, I was 20, so she wasn't going to have many other chances, whereas it looked like I would have, you know, years of it. But it hurts, and I think, for me, quite a strange thing for Angela. She's a very guarded person to think that she might give an opponent a 6-4, 4-3 and 40-30 lead and, you know, come back and win. It'd be taking quite a chance, I would have thought. You normally want to get on top, get ahead, not plan to win a match from that far down. But anyway, whatever. It always comes back and haunts me a bit. I have to say that because she's a Wimbledon champion and I never did get back to that position again. I got to semifinals again, I think, in 1965. But I was never the Christine Truman that I remembered. I was not the same, really, after that.
It was an incredible moment, that. David and I think sort of glanced at one another like, Wow, this is really, really, really poignant. And a lot of that interview was very poignant. And yeah, it's life-affirming stuff from Christine. So that is up now for friends at the Tennis Podcast, as is Hannah's most recent column. David mentioned it earlier. It's about Emma Raducanu. The Barge has been buzzing with chat about various different things. Don't worry, the Taylor Swift-related chat is enclosed within one thread, so it doesn't seep into the chat of people that don't wish to exclusively talk about Taylor Swift's most recent album. But it's a broad church, folks. There's stuff there for everybody, whatever your persuasion. And of course, tomorrow we are recording our TV and film review show, and that'll be going up for friends of the Tennis Podcast. So if you'd like to become a friend of the pod, the link to do so is in our show notes, or you can go to tennis.supportingcast.fm to join. On to Barcelona, which just looked to have an absolutely glorious week of weather this week. I gazed longingly into my TV at the bright blazing sunshine as Casper Ruud won his first ATP 500 level title, avenging the defeat to Stefanos Tsitsipas in the Monte Carlo final of just a week ago, and winning this time around 7-5, 6-3 in what I can only describe as a deep, deep troll of Catherine Whittaker and her predictions.
I mean, that this is 3 weeks
like
in a row, isn't it?
Personal attack.
David tried to warn you.
What? No. Okay. So last week, I had Casper Ruud, and he loses to Tsitsipas in the final. I was very scarred by that loss. If that wasn't clear on last week's podcast, I thought he was appalling in that final. Really. So I'm looking at this week's predictions. I'm liking the look of the Barcelona draw, and I'm thinking Ruud or Tsitsipas. And then the trauma of the Monte Carlo final hits me like a freight train. I'm like, what are you doing, Catherine? Casper's lost you forever. So I went with Tsitsipas. And the universe told me what it thinks of me.
And I did tell you. Immediately, I that doesn't seem like a good idea.
You did, because
this was you'd gone 2 weeks in a row with Ruud, and he got to the final both times and lost. So
yeah, I'm one of those people, you know, those lurkers in casinos on the fruit machine thingies that pick up that profit off the despair of the people that have come before them. They lurk to. I'm the mug who they're all profiting from. I put my coins into the machine with no return, and there's Casper Ruud jumping into a swimming pool with a trophy.
He was good though, wasn't he?
He was really good. Where was that 7 days ago? It's like a different guy.
Do you think it's quite hard when you've beaten somebody as handily as Tsitsipas did, and you then play the same player again? You know, It's so easy to think, oh, well, the same will just happen. But I think it's really hard to play that player again because it must get worse.
And I guess it was an occasion where I always wonder about the psychology of whether it's best to lose having played your best or lose having played badly psychologically. And I guess for Ruud, after the Monte Carlo final, he could at least say, well, I lost because I played really badly. If I play well, I've still got a chance. Whereas if you lose having played your best, I think I would find that psychologically quite difficult to cope with going into the next meeting, because I'd think, well, what's the point in playing well? They'll get me anyway, unless they're having a bad day. But it feels less within your control, I suppose.
Mm. I'm just so impressed the fact that he got to this final for a start. I mean, week after week after week, he just produces and gets somewhere most of the time. I mean, what a pro for a start to do that. And then to really turn it on in that final. I mean, he was hitting his backhand better than I've ever seen it hit. I mean, I know he beat Novak Djokovic in Monte Carlo, and there were some elements to that there. You know, you're thinking, is that Casper Ruud's backhand? Has he borrowed somebody else's? Because that doesn't look like his at all. But he's clearly worked bloody hard on it, and he went after Tsitsipas. I mean, he was broken immediately in that final. And I thought there were a couple of really nice plays from Tsitsipas. He was doing that Federer thing of floating a chip backhand approach sort of inside the service box and rushing in after it and bringing in Ruud. And he won both of those points, did Tsitsipas. But Ruud just dug in and he just went after the ball big time. I think he's a credit to himself, really, the way he just keeps on coming back for more, no matter how much. You know, it really struck me this week. Some weeks it strikes me just how much disappointment players have to stomach, you know, because you so rarely win the tournament. And he's lost to all these finals. What is it, about five finals in a row? And he's never won a 500 or a 1,000 event. You know, he's reached these Grand Slam finals, but he's never the guy with the trophy, you know, unless it's a 250. Well, you don't want to be that guy, do you? I mean, it's great on one level. You're a rich man. You're having loads of success generally, but you want to be breaking that. And he's done it. I think this is a big deal.
Yeah, I think he's such a learner, Casper Ruud, who keeps coming back and keeps getting a little bit better. Like, he's not going to just suddenly do something out of the blue that he's never become close to doing before. Like, he has to take the steps, and, you know, he's the sort of embodiment of the Stan Wawrinka quote, you know, fail once and then fail again, but fail better. And I think last week I spoke about his sort of lack of belief a little bit against these top players, and he sort of referenced that himself this week, saying he knew he needed a different approach against Tsitsipas. He almost paid Tsitsipas too much respect in that final in Monte Carlo, whereas this time he decided to take it to Tsitsipas, and he was heading out on his forehand, and as David said, his backhand was an absolute revelation, especially down the line. He's improved that much, that shot out of sight. Yeah, it just takes him a few goes to do something. And yeah, like, he's sort of getting better all the time, and he's now got that 500 level title to show for it. But I must say, I do think the oddest, most inexplicable stat in tennis right now is Tsitsipas being 0-11 in Masters 500, in ATP 500 finals. Like, 0-11.
Doesn't make any sense.
It's extraordinary how he cannot get his hands on one of these titles. Like, it's really weird. He's lost in four or five Barcelona finals now, I think. Like,
you could have told me about... So at the time of my prediction, it was 0-10.
Yeah, but then Ruud never wins anything above a 250. No. So it was
well,
two
exactly.
Curses against each other, yeah.
It's not like you were listening to us, Catherine.
That's
anyway.
True. David told you and you you ignored him.
And then you're probably also thinking, well, David, what do you ever get right?
Trauma alters the neurological pathways of your brain. That much we know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, he was really, really good. Rude. This Sunday, what? Not the Sunday before. This Sunday, he was really, really good. Well done, Casper
Ruud.
What
does it mean, folks? What does it mean for Casper Ruud? Is this a new level? Is he now in the mix?
For Roland
Garros?
I
think he probably is in the mix, yeah.
Mm. I think he has to be.
A two-time finalist in form at a Rafael Nadal-less Roland Garros with an injured Carlos, you know, even if Alcaraz and Djokovic come good for Rome, it still will have been a suboptimal preparation for them. This could be quite an open Roland Garros. I think a two-time finalist in form has to be in the mix.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think that's a step up, don't you? I mean, I think we often say, well, he's the guy we never really give the... the expectation that he will go on and win. And I certainly feel like I'm in that camp. I would always put half a dozen other players ahead of him. But all those other players, maybe Sinner aside, there are question marks over at the moment. And even with Sinner, because he's not done it on clay and he's not done it at Roland Garros, it just makes... I still think those guys at their best beat Ruud. But I don't feel as confident that he's going to run into one of them in that form. But I still would be surprised if Ruud isn't there somewhere.
Yeah, agree. Agree with all of that. No notes. Nadal, let's get on to the Nadal of it all in Barcelona. Beat Flavio Caboli handily in the opening round. I think it's fair to say Caboli was a little bit overawed by the occasion. And I guess playing Rafa Nadal on Pista Rafael Nadal, maybe we'll cut him a bit of slack for that. But I did think it was an absolute shocker of a performance from him.
His unforced error count agreed.
27 unforced errors in a 6-2 set. And I thought that was generous. I felt like I'd watched more than 27.
It was like he just forgot the concept of trying to construct a rally.
Right, yeah. He forgot the dimensions of a tennis court and the point of a rally.
You know how you're a tennis player? Play tennis.
Right. But I guess, you know, the whole playing the guy on the court the guy's named after.
It was like, understandable.
It is absurd. They should have waited, but they didn't. It's been called that since 2017. It's ridiculous. Anyway, so he beats Caboli in the opening round, and he's holding back here and there on the serve, isn't he, and on some of the movement, but it basically, overall, given how low and unsure expectations were, I think basically it was an encouraging performance. And then in the second round, Nadal lost out to Alex de Minaur, which is the exact opposite of Flavio Caboli in the opening round, who was just gifting him hemorrhaging errors and brain farts. Alex de Minaur gives you absolutely nothing. It's kind of the nightmare opponent for somebody on the comeback trail as Rafael Nadal is. But really, I think the Rafael Nadal situation is all about the quote he gave after that loss to Alex de Minaur. He talked about how he is broadly encouraged by his experience of playing Barcelona. He was encouraged by the fact that he was able to be competitive despite not letting himself and his body go completely. He basically has told us, I have one tournament left in my canister to give it everything, to let myself go. And that tournament is going to be Roland Garros. He says, I will try to take another step forward in Madrid, then in Rome. And if in a tournament it is worth going out there to give everything and die for it, then it is Paris. I get goosebumps every time I see that quote. He's got one chance to die on a tennis court and end his career. And he's going to do it at Roland Garros. It could be in the first round. It could be in the fourth round. It could be in the final. I don't know. But he's going to die on the court. And then come back in a few months and play Lever Cup.
I got goosebumps as you were reading it out,
Catherine. It's pretty spine-tingling stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. And yeah. I mean, it wasn't bad. It wasn't too bad in Barcelona. It was better than I feared. He still feels like he's round-arming the serve over, but it was certainly better than I feared. And I don't feel like... He didn't look like he suffered setbacks during this match like he did during that exhibition against Alcaraz a couple of months ago. And so, as he says, is what it is. Can he do a bit better at the next couple? Even if not, can he get to the start line in Roland Garros and just empty the tank, whatever's left? And, you know, remember how well Joe Wilfried Tsonga played in his sort of final match at Roland Garros? And I just feel like you wouldn't want to play him. You still wouldn't want to play Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros. If you drew him, I don't care who you are, you're thinking, oh, God. That guy.
That 14-time champion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
who's prepared to literally die on the court. Yeah, I don't think I'd want to play that.
Roland Garros. There's not many people. And he's won that many. So, yeah. And also, my mind always goes back to a couple of years ago when he turned up with his zombie foot, you know, and his inability to walk without having his foot frozen completely. And it was Zverev who said that during practice he suddenly looked like a different player, like to what he'd seen in the other tournaments. You can't rule that out, that he might actually have a couple of weeks where he doesn't feel too bad. And imagine if he doesn't feel too bad.
Or, you know, just numbs the body part that doesn't feel good.
Just numb the
apparently
whole body,
that's an option. He's going to do it with a zombie torso this time.
Yeah, like he's kind of already been through this, hasn't he? Of like leaving everything out there at Roland Garros, as you said, that kind of was the case in 2022. I heard Casper Ruud give an interview. I'm going to have to credit the source, and that source was UTS. I do think they do very good player interviews where they sort of sit down and have a meal and sort of talk to each other. And Ruud said that the day after he lost to Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros, he saw Rafael Nadal on crutches, which was kind of like a sort of mind fuck for him. Like, oh my God, I just lost to that guy yesterday. I didn't get anywhere near him, and now he's on crutches. But, you know, that was Nadal, like, leaving everything on the court at Roland Garros. And, like, there was an exhilarating 20 minutes against de Menor when he got that first set back on track. And it was really stark. Like, wow, OK, that's the Rafael Nadal that we know and love. He just didn't have it in him for much longer than about an hour. And he spoke about that afterwards. So he needs to build up some match fitness because he was fatigued and he just couldn't keep it going. And he didn't, as you said, he didn't want to let go and sort of give everything either. He's, in true Nadal fashion, he spoke about needing to be very logical about this. You know, he does something in Madrid and then he ramps up a little bit more at Rome and just building the blocks ahead of Roland Garros. He's got a very interesting draw in Madrid in that he's got Darwin Blanche in the first round, who was born in 2007. So, like, has absolutely no memory whatsoever of many of Rafael Nadal's sort of biggest career moments. And then in the second round, if Nadal wins that, it's Alex de Menor again.
Yeah. That's kind of a dream first round and a nightmare second round, isn't it? It's Caboli, de Menor all over again.
Yeah, it's very similar. And yet, you know, maybe it's a perfect test to see how much further along you've come a couple of weeks later, you know, play Alex de Menor again and try and do a bit better, I suppose. Like maybe you could
play each other in Rome, Nadal wins.
Wow. I love a David unsolicited prediction.
Okay. So long as he doesn't die doing it and he saves the...
I don't mean he wins Rome. I mean he beats Alex de Menor if they play each other again.
Okay, I think de Menor's tough. I think that's tough wherever. But I'll go with it, David. On to Munich. David, you said earlier in the pod that Stuttgart is the only indoor clay court event on either tour in professional tennis. It shouldn't be, should it? Munich should be an indoor event. If they're going to hold it in mid-April, you need to put a roof on it and probably some central heating.
I didn't see a single player bearing skin throughout the whole tournament. They were all wearing those Lycra trousers and arm sleeves and looking cold and miserable and fed up. And so were all the crowd. And I mean, fair play to them. They all turned out for the final. There was a really great full packed crowd for the final, which Jan-Lennard Struff, who made it look like it wasn't cold the way he played tennis. He's on a damp clay court in cold conditions and he's just hitting blazing winners through it. And I love watching him.
Damp, cold clay does favour the agricultural, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You need to be a bit agricultural to make your game resonate in those conditions.
Yes. Yeah. And he is a sneaky agricultural player because, I always used to think of him as a tall, big server, but he's suddenly become this barrel-chested bruiser. And here he is at 33 winning his first ever career title. And I find him so likeable. He had that incredible run, didn't he, last year in Madrid, and he had that coach who was really going for it with him, and then he had that horrible injury. And he looked like he wasn't going to be able to really become a factor again because he was so badly injured after that. And I mean, look, he's beaten some proper players at this tournament. You know, he's beaten Felix Auger-Aliassime and Holger Rune, I think, in the same day. I mean, frankly, Rune didn't offer much opposition. That was a 45-minute match, which I didn't see. And I think, Matt, you may have gone back to rewatch, didn't you? But
Do bear in mind, though, David, that Rune's mum has told us that he wasn't well. So.
Oh.
Okay. Honestly, when Rune wins tennis matches, I just sit strumming my fingers waiting for the social media explanation of why he wasn't fully able to compete.
I love Struff, and I was talking earlier about the perseverance. You know, we've got another one with Martin Fucsovics, who won his second title of his career, you know, 6 years after his first. And just looking at the faces after these things, all this struggle to try to be the last player standing, and how rarely it happens, even for the good players. I think Sloane Stephens in her whole career has won about 7 or 8 titles. You know, it's not that many. And when they get it, they've really got to make the most of it. And you could see on the face of both Fucsovics and Struff how much it means. And Rude, you know, just this kind of like, I did it. I finally got over the line in one of these things and you can't take it away from me. So good luck. Good work to him.
And I've always thought of Struff as a player who gets pretty tight. Like, I don't back him in really close matches very often, and I was very impressed with how well he played under pressure yesterday. Certainly the end of that first set, he saved loads of set points and then just reeled off a series of points in a row to win that first set. And then he did get tight when he had to serve it out. Fortunately, he had a double break, but actually he didn't need it because he failed to serve it out but then broke to win. And yeah, it's a really nice moment for someone at 33 to not only get their first title but to do it like at home as well. And yeah, I was really, really impressed with Jan-Lennard Struff. And as you said, like, he's defending loads of points from Madrid last year, so nice that he sort of banked these 250 in Munich as well this week just prior. Should just quickly say, by the way, Rouen says hi as another indoor clay tennis event.
Literally this week.
Yeah, although
David,
it's the first
David,
time
you fake newsed me into going off piste with the agenda again.
Is it a new tournament?
It's been upgraded to a 250. It's sort of been on the calendar, but not on the WTA.
David, we should never state facts that aren't Matt Roberts approved. That's
you're right.
What we've learned.
Imagine how we got on for what was it, about 4 years before we even met Matt. Imagine if you go into the archives and found all the mistakes.
Don't do it. David, you watched the Bucharest final. Martin Fucsovics beating Mariano Navone
is what the commentator was saying. Listen, this was one of those tournaments that is Jan Tyriak organised. It looked like it got quite a lot of enthusiasm around it.
However, would you know, David, that Jan Tyriak organised it? Very hard to tell.
Yeah, I mean, he's got his name on it.
It's called the Tyriak Open.
Yes, he's nigh on doing that thing that the boxing promoter Eddie Hearn does when he puts two boxers face to face, eyeball to eyeball, and he puts his own head in between them. And Tyriak was virtually doing that when he handed the trophy over. He was sort of applauding in a shot that you couldn't possibly crop him out of. But you know, and it was one of those camera angles for the TV coverage that wasn't exactly ideal, but I still enjoyed watching these two guys going for it in which was, you know, probably one of the biggest matches of their lives. Certainly Navone and Fucsovics winning in his second title, as I said. I mean, he, at the end of it, he was just sort of motionless on his haunches for several seconds, just taking it in, because he's been around a long time and he just hasn't won titles. He's won one in 2018 in Geneva, but, you know, he's won another one, and good for him. I don't expect him to be a factor beyond what he's been in the past anywhere, but he's got over the line in a tournament, and, well, that's something to remember forever for him.
Two big wins for Fucsovics this year, winning the Bucharest title and Grigor Dimitrov being absolutely horrified that he didn't feature in the top 10 most handsome men on the ATP list. You've seen that video, David? You look confused.
I can't say I have.
He was scandalised at Fucsovics's lack of inclusion.
It was pretty much the
list.
First name he came up with, wasn't it?
Yeah, Fucsovics, of course.
So I've got to catch up on 31 Taylor Swift songs and go and watch the Martin Fucsovics isn't handsome enough for the top 10 list.
Yeah, it's good.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Some bits and bobs of news from the week, leading with the retirement of two-time Grand Slam champion and former world number one, Garbiñe Muguruza. She has retired from the sport. It's a funny one, this, because obviously that's a huge deal, you know, listing her achievements there. And there are many more besides. Other Grand Slam finals, WTA finals champion a couple of years ago, extraordinarily. You know, she made an incredible contribution to the sport. And yet, this doesn't feel like big news because kind of in my mind, she was already retired, really. I was pretty sure she wasn't going to return to the sport. I know Instagram can be misleading, but she looks really happy. And since she announced that she was going to take a break from the sport, I think a bit over a year ago, she doesn't strike me as somebody that's looked back at all. I'm sure in private moments she's missed it, but it seemed very clear to me that she was at peace with no longer being involved in tennis. And I don't know whether there's bit of a sadness there that, you know, the sport wasn't able to find a way to accommodate someone like that and make her happy. But she certainly seems happy now. And we wish her well in her retirement, of course. But it is a shame that tennis didn't get her at her peak for longer, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I've been thinking about Muguruza quite a lot this weekend. One of my friends who loves sport but isn't massively into tennis sort of asked me straight away, should she have achieved more? And my sort of immediate response was that would feel quite a harsh take on her career. As you said, like two slam titles, beating Serena and Venus in those finals. I think she's the only person to have done that. World number one, an Australian Open final, a Wimbledon final. Like, these are all massive achievements. And side note, she also gave us one of the great aggro quotes of all time, being that Kiki Mladenovic speaks 25 languages. We will always savour Garbiñe Muguruza for that press conference at Roland Garros. Just absolute aggro sweet spot. But, you know, only 10 titles in total. So I suppose sort of she won big, but maybe didn't win that much. But I think what it is for me is there is this slight nagging sense of sadness about her career in a way, because I don't know about you, but my sort of introduction to Muguruza, I know she'd done some things before, but my big introduction was when she beat Serena at Roland Garros in 2014. She arrived with such a bang, such a powerful force, and that her career has sort of ended in sort of the opposite of that, sort of fizzling out, because, as you said, she wasn't that happy on the tour, and that I think does come with some great sadness. And yes, there were peaks, but even before she took this break, there were some real troughs in her career as well. And, you know, I think back to a lot of the interactions with Sam Sumik, and that was always a very uncomfortable sort of relationship to observe as well. So even sort of during some of the best years of her career, there were also these moments where you felt like maybe she wasn't all that sort of happy on tour. So I'm really pleased for her that she seems happy now and in her sort of new life. And as you said, I wasn't shocked by this decision. And I don't think of her as a great underachiever. And yet sort of if the circumstances were right a little bit more, maybe she could have done more. But yeah, like one of the most fascinating careers, I think, of the last 10 years or so, just sort of so interesting. And yeah, she sort of left her mark on the game, even though there were, you know, it wasn't the longest career.
Yeah, I actually thought when she first came along, I wouldn't have expected her to do as well as she did. And then she forced her way into this feeling that she could dominate the sport. She was the one I was really thinking was going to pick it up from Serena Williams. And when she won her second Grand Slam and then she became world number one, that's when it seemed to get unhappy, or at least that's how it came across. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but the she didn't look happy out there, and the results were never quite the same again. Because I mean, when she would initially come into press conferences and in that sort of 2015 era, she was so enjoyable to talk to, so open, so comfortable in the media's company. And that did change, and that may be partly our fault as a media group. I don't know. You'd have to ask her. But it definitely, lots of things changed in the way she came across. And like you, Catherine, I've seen the feeling, at least since she's stopped playing, and it wasn't an announcement that I'm going to retire. It was just I'm going to take a break. And then suddenly her demeanour changed too. And it is a bit of a shame not to have a moment that we can say, right, like Joe Wilfried Tsonga and all the other players that have said goodbye to tennis, for people to be able to say goodbye to them and them to do the same. But whatever. It's been a great career she's had, and I really wish her the best.
Shame there's not women at the Laver Cup, and then maybe there would be a vehicle for retirement moments for some female players as well, because it does sound like that's what's kind of being laid on for Nadal at Laver Cup, for him to have the same experience that Roger Federer had a couple of years ago. Matt, an update on Roberts versus Reddit from last week?
Yes. My update is that I've been gaslit by Jannik Sinner, because the reason I didn't think he was cramping was that he took a medical timeout during that match, and you cannot take a medical timeout for cramping. So I thought, okay, well, it's clearly an injury. But then he admitted, apparently, I've checked and been told, he admitted in the Italian portion of his press conference that he sort of told the umpire that it was an injury when actually it sort of was cramp that he was experiencing. He didn't say the word cramp, I don't think, but he sort of described cramp, and he said it was brought on by nerves, by the fact that he didn't manage to get that second break against Tsitsipas, and his sort of body tensed up.
They all do it, don't they?
But I didn't think Jannik Sinner would necessarily do it.
I mean, I'm loath to have a whinge about it because I don't have a solution. But the cramping rules are satisfactory, aren't they? Because it treats cramp as a loss of conditioning. And of course it can be, but I think it's actually rarely linked to that. First of all, some people are just more prone to it than others. It's about muscle mass. It's about stress. I just think that the rules treat it physiologically far too simplistically, but again, I don't have the solution, so yeah, which is very Billie Jean King won't be happy about that, will she? Only complain about things if you have a solution to put forward. I'll keep thinking about it, but just a whinge at this stage. I mentioned that Matt and I watched the Kostyuk and Goff match together on Friday. We all watched the latter stages of the Raducanu-Świątek match together on Friday. And that was all really nice, wasn't it? We had a nice time watching tennis together on Friday. The reason that we were all together down here in Southwest London at Tennis Podcast Towers was for rather less happy reasons. We all attended the memorial service for Mike Dixon, the Daily Mail's tennis correspondent that many of you will remember passed away very suddenly out in Australia during the Australian Open. It was something that, of course, impacted us at the time, and we received a lot of incredibly lovely messages from listeners around that time. And it was a strange one on Friday because obviously a tremendously sad occasion of an incredible family man, clearly, and a great, great journalist taken far before his time. And yet also there were elements of wonder and happiness about the occasion as well. There were, I think, close to 700 people at this memorial service in Wimbledon. It truly was a sight to behold, this many people gathering to pay tribute to Mike. We arrived about 15 minutes early, didn't we, for the service. And the church, a huge church, it has to be said, in Wimbledon, it was already full. And we were directed towards an overflow room to watch the service on a projector, and there were a lot of people in that overflow room. It was really, really moving, David, to see that many people want to take time out of their days and their lives to pay tribute to Mike, and it told a huge story.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that before. And there was a line in one of the eulogies given by the journalist Jonathan McAvoy, who's a colleague of Mike's, a good friend of his at the Daily Mail, and he said, "I cannot think of anybody in sports journalism who would have this number of people turn out for them." And Mike was 10 days shy of his 60th birthday. He was, as we discussed at the time, there was no obvious sign of ill health, and it was such a shock to all. I left in awe at the reaction from everybody who was there towards him, as I was in awe of his career. And perhaps most of all, I was in awe of his family, because his wife and his three children, who are now, you know, either late teenagers or early to late 20s, all spoke. And the stories they told and the way they told them about their dad was incredible to me, and I can only imagine how proud of them he was throughout his life, and I'm really glad that I knew him, and I'm really sad that he's gone, as I'm sure everybody there will feel the same.
Absolutely, and we'll be thinking of Mike's family, I think, over the coming weeks and months. And yeah, it was an incredibly moving day on Friday, and I'm glad we were all able to be there, and I'm glad we were all able to be there together. And it felt fitting, wasn't it, that we left and we all came back to watch Emma Raducanu, which is exactly what Mike would have been doing as well, sort of surreptitiously checking the scores over our glass of wine at the wake, telling ourselves it's okay because Mike would have been doing this too. A quick look ahead to what we've got this week. I've touched upon some elements of the draws in Madrid. The WTA main draw starts tomorrow, Tuesday, and the ATP starts on Wednesday, of course, different times. Why would it not be? We have round one matches on the WTA side, which includes Sloane Stephens against Martina Trevisan, Mirandrave against Taylor Townsend, and Raducanu against not Karolina Pliskova, because Pliskova's withdrawn. Świątek, Goff, Jabeur and Sakkari are all in the top half, with Sabalenka, Rybakina, Vondroušová, Collins and Zhongqin Wen all in the bottom half. And we have Jessica Pegula out injured, continuing what's been a tricky season for her so far. On the ATP side, Djokovic has withdrawn for non-medical reasons. no idea what that relates to. Hope he's okay. Hope his family's okay. I guess he's trying to say there, you know, I'm fit and I'm healthy. So we would expect to see him in Rome. Carlos Alcaraz, of course, has been suffering with that forearm injury. He's the defending champion. He is in the draw as things stand at the moment. So we have round ones that include Darwin Blanche against Rafael Nadal, with, as discussed, the winner to play Alex de Minaur. Nishioka against Felix Auger-Aliassime. Best player in the world, Thomas Mahatch, against Emil Ruiz Savory and Aslan Karatsev, against Fabian Marajan. Sinner, Medvedev, Ruud and Tsitsipas are all in the top half, with Hurkacz, Zverev, Rublev, Alcaraz and Rune all in the bottom half. Going to be a lot of eyes on Carlos Alcaraz and how that forearm is. I saw some footage of him practicing this week, but he didn't have a tennis racket in his hand, which... I realise tennis players do all sorts of drills, but it didn't fill me with massive confidence, I have to say.
No.
He was doing air swings.
Wishing him luck.
Wishing him luck. Yeah, absolutely. And that is it. That's your wrap on the week that was. And you'll look ahead to the first week of 2 weeks of Madrid. Of course, we have a mascot for this episode. That mascot is Luna. Luna is an 8-year-old domestic short hair cat who's owned by Justin Robinson. And he says, my wife and I adopted her when she was 8 weeks old and weighed a hefty 1.5 pounds. Now, I don't know if that's an ironic hefty there, because 1.5 pounds sounds like nothing to me.
I think
but
they're wrong.
Anyway. Right, okay. Due to a neurological condition, Luna can't jump very high and is very clumsy and gallops like a horse when she runs, but she makes up for all that by being an expert napper and cuddler and a master of soaking up all of the Southern California sun. While we'd like to think we are her favourite things in the world, we have a feeling it's probably wet food and treats. She especially loves chasing her treats and hunting for them like she's a lion stalking a gazelle. Luna is very sweet and affectionate and has never met a person or cardboard box she doesn't instantly love. And the picture of Luna is so cute. She's grey with a white ruff, little white patch on her forehead, little white patch on her mouth and white paws, which you call socks, don't you? It's like she's got socks on. And she's absolutely adorable. So thank you, Luna. And thank you, Justin, Luna's owner. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin. There's no need to revisit the trauma of what happened to us this week. David and Francis, how did you fare with João Fonseca?
It was going okay until it wasn't. And I would just like to say, Catherine, you are the Casper Ruud of the predictions, aren't you? So kind of all these finals in a row, and now is the week. See?
Is that David trying to goad me into picking Casper Ruud for Madrid?
No.
No?
It's me trying to soften the blow of all these disappointments, okay. Catherine, because there's always next week.
That's very David, that advice, isn't it? Very much reusable analysis of our predictions competition, that it was going really well until it wasn't. Matt, Haider and Soma?
Yeah, sorry, Haider and Soma. My pick was ill, which was why he lost.
Rune?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. According to his mum, anyway. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And it's over to you, Matt, for shout-outs.
We have an Australian theme to our shout-outs today, all three from Australia. And we start with Kate Sale in Sydney.
All right, Kate.
Hello, Kate.
Kate says, you can tell Catherine if she asks that Kate is short for Kathleen. So I think that maybe puts me in the church car park, she says.
I would say that's about right, Kate. Church car park. great place to be.
Can't think of any Kathleens though in the tennis world, which is a bit of a blow for me. So, Pam, Mary, over to you.
We always struggle, and Kate we always end up doing Katie as well, don't we?
I know. It's terrible. No Kates will ever become shout out friends because we let them down every time. We can talk about Sydney. That's where Kate's from. Or maybe we can't talk about Sydney.
I've been and it's very nice.
It's great. Yes, we like Sydney. We like Kate. Thank you very much, Kate.
And our next shout out is also from Sydney, Coda Farha.
Oh, how are we spelling Coda?
K-H-O-D-E-R.
Oh, okay. Because Coda, spelt K-O-D-A, means a friend to everybody in a language. And I mean, obviously different spelling, different language, different everything. But that's a nice thing, isn't it?
And our Coda is a big Medvedev, Świątek, Kasatkina and Ons Jabeur fan. Strong.
Oh, good taste, Coda.
Good selection.
Love that. Life goal is to attend all the majors, has been to the Australian Open, and this year is going to the US Open.
Oh.
Go on, Coda.
Go on, Coda. Two more to go. We love it when people are on the pursuit of the career fan slam. That's a great thing. Thank you very much, Coda.
And finally today, we have Paulie and Linda Owen from Brisbane.
Hey.
Hello, Paulie and Linda. That sounds like a 60s sort of folksy band, like the Mamas and the Papas, doesn't it? Or Peter, Paul and Mary. As you were, Matt.
Paulie says that in the early 1980s, he ball boyed for Ilina Stasi, Ken Rosewall, John Newcomb and Stan Smith in a Legends exhibition match in Brisbane.
Wow.
That's cool. Those are good names. Well, Brisbane is somewhere I know very well. My parents used to live there. So at one time, it was like a second home to me. So lovely stuff. Thank you to all of Australia that supports the tennis podcast.
And
no,
those
no
that
one got
don't.
Anything else on, and those that don't. Yeah.
Like
love you, Australia.
Linda Fruvertova.
Very good. And Linda Noskova, among the favourites for the French Open.
And actually, Paulie has clarified, no, Linda is not from the Czech Republic.
Very good.
I enjoyed that.
Thank you, Paulie and Linda.
Very good. Thank you, Paulie, Linda, Kate and Coda.
Coda.
Yeah. Thank you very much to our shout-outs for this week. Thank you to all friends of the Tennis Podcast. Thank you. I can't even say podcast. Podcast. Thank you for listening. And we'll speak to you next week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.